The Toronto Raptors season has been kind of so-so.
Bit of a roller coaster.
Yeah, but what's really surprising though is the way their record is. They're 7-7, but they can't win at home and they can't lose on the road. You know, the exact opposite of what you would expect. Nonetheless, I don't know what that means. They're in Portland tonight, and so Michael Grange of Sportsnet and Doug Smith of the Toronto Star actually are both traveling. Been a long time since we saw our media pals on the road with professional sports teams. They will join us, and we will chat about the Toronto Raptors and the NBA in general when the Bob and Cowan podcast continues after these messages. McCowan and Shannon back with you, and two of our faves, Michael Grange of Sportsnet, Doug Smith of the Toronto Star, both in Portland, where the Raptors get set to play. That's the
Portland, Oregon. Portland, Oregon.
As opposed to?
Portland, Maine.
Portland, Maine is about the size, is about eight people.
I know, but, you know, we just have to be a little more particular, you know?
And that's only when the bus gets there. Before the bus arrives, there's only four
of
them.
Come on. Great.
I think we all know. And besides which, Portland, Oregon, or Portland, Maine does not have any professional sports franchises that I'm aware of. In any event, this Raptor team got off to a decent start, won five in a row, started to look pretty good. And then one of the things that happened was Pascal Siakam came back, and you can't point the finger at him. He's played okay. But I guess, Smitty, this is a process of integrating not just any player, but a player of significance and who you want to get the ball to regularly into the system, right?
Yeah, it's going to take, you know, 8 or 10 games to work to weed itself out, because you have basically three positionless forwards in Anunoby, Barnes, and Siakam, and they got to figure out issues of spacing, shot distribution, where the shots come from on the court, when they come in the shot clock. Fred VanVleet has to figure out how to get them all sort of going at the right time. And yeah, it's going to take 8 or 10 games, but it's going to work. Cause that Saturday night, Siakam looked great in most of the game against Detroit, really 25-12. VanVleet didn't play, but so give it, you know, I don't think you can really judge any basketball team until 20 or 25 games into an NBA season. And these guys have been together for three. So it's going to take some time to figure out exactly what they are. I still think they're very good.
And Grange, it's important to note that, I mean, this isn't a guy who's come back from an injury after he's played with this group before. I guess they literally had not played together in any meaningful way until he returned to the lineup, right?
Yeah, I mean, Siakam and Gary Trent have never played together, really, because at the end of the year, Siakam was shut down. Obviously, he's never played with Scottie Barnes. And so, you know, Ken Birch is also new. So, and you could see that at times. Gary Trent and Pascal kind of bumping into each other at various moments. But, you know, I think defensively, these guys should be good sooner than later. That is the plan, right? Like, I mean, you know, it's not about becoming, you know, the second coming of the Golden State Warriors. It's about, or at least it is in the sense that they've been the number one defense at times. But it is about having three guys, as Doug says, positionless, who can guard anybody. And then if you're on the floor with them plus Ken Birch and them plus Fred VanVleet or whatever combination you get in there, you know, you should be a really, really good defensive team that can both, as Nick Nurse would say, keep your guy in front of you, but also, you know, when you get into rotations and switches, not have to give up anything because you're always switching onto another good defender. And, you know, that shouldn't take, you know, weeks and months. That should happen sooner than later, and it's going to need to on this road trip.
Michael, when we had Pascal on, he talked about understanding or realizing that he had to create a bigger leadership role with Lowry gone. Do you see that yet?
I think what you've seen is him being a more effusive personality. I think you know I think he had a lot of stuff on his shoulders, you know, on his mind the last couple of years. Some we know of, some we don't. But I think, you know, what we've seen when you think of Pascal Siakam early in his career, he was that. He was a delight to be in the NBA. And it kind of, his energy was very palpable and it showed on the floor. And, you know, and I think what you've seen this preseason, before he started playing, is, you know, his activity on the bench. I mean, it doesn't mean much, but he was super engaged, super positive, really kind of being as active as you could be when you're not playing. And then, and he has spoken, in addition to, you know, the interview we had with you, like what he has talked about, the need for him to kind of push himself out of his comfort zone and be a more kind of a mentor type role. So, you know, that's what they're paying him to do. And that, you know, and you know, that's not something you can measure game by game or day by day. But I think, you know, for Pascal Siakam, I think it's really going to, you want to pay attention to his body language. I think he does sort of, you can see him kind of shrink and drag himself a bit when he's kind of, we saw that the last couple of years and we haven't seen it yet. And it's going to be up to him to kind of lead, at least through that example as well.
We all grew up watching this game and understanding, you know, that there are five players on the court and each one has a different role. There's a, you know, the point guard, and then there's the shooting guard, and then there's a center, and then there's two wing guys who may be shooters, maybe rebounders. But the game has changed, and it certainly has changed for the Raptors. Have they done this deliberately, though, or have they done it because they had to, Smitty?
I think they've done it deliberately. I think that they see that's the way the game is going, and it's not gonna go backwards. It's only gonna go to more multi-positional. Everybody 6'9" can shoot and dribble. You know, Nick said that since he took the job 4 years ago. He wants everybody on the court to be able to shoot 3-pointers. He would love them to all be 6'9" and have long and 7'2" wingspan, which is a dream. But I think they see that's where the game is going. That's where the athletic bodies are going. You look at the physiology of people, that's what you're seeing. And they want to get out ahead of that. And the earlier you start molding your group, here's a perfect example. They kept Isaac Bonda over Sam Decker because he's 6'8" with 7'2" wingspan and Decker isn't. Hmm. Decker is a better basketball player today than Isaac Bonga is, but Bonga seemed to fit this prototypical where we going in the 2020s era of basketball. And I think Mazai and Bobby have made a conscious effort to seek out those kind of guys. That's why they took Barnes over Suggs. They like his 6'9" length, foot speed, foot quickness, willingness to guard. And, you know, I think that's where they're going to go. And they made a conscious decision years ago to go that way.
How does Van Vliet fit into that?
Well, you need an outlier. You need someone 6'1". But, you know, Fred's great for this group because he is, like Mike said, you know, Pascal is the good cop. Fred's a bad cop. Fred's going to get in guys' faces and not be the effusive, public supporting, engaged guy. He's gonna rip guys. And you need that on a team. They would love Fred to be 6'4", believe me. But, you know, who knows what happens in 3 years with him. Maybe the next contract, they say, okay, we need to find a 6'8" guy. And maybe that 6'7" guy is Delano Banton, for all we know, who is a prototypical where the game's going kind of guy.
So are we, is the traditional 7-foot center now about to become a dinosaur in the NBA, Grange?
Traditional in the sense of he kind of occupies the paint and he goes block to block and everything stops while they post him up. I don't think, you know, the only guy doing that in the league right now to any great degree are Joel Embiid and Nikola Jokic, and both of them also have the ability to spread the floor and step out and shoot threes, which allows, you know, what you want to do is you want to have open 3-point shots and open shots at the rim. And the way the geometry of the game has gone is the way to do that is still attack the rim. So you collapse the defense. If the defense doesn't collapse, you get that layup. What you are getting in terms of a traditional big, or the new version of a traditional big, and it's something the Raptors lack, is vertical spacing. So you want somebody who is a threat rolling to the rim in that pick and roll action with a point guard or whoever the ball handler is to be, you know, you have that option of throwing that lob up to the rim. Think of Clint Capella with Atlanta, or, you know, any, you know, Jared Allen, you know, Gobert with Utah, Jared Allen with Cleveland. You know, so that's the modern version of a post-up pop. It is a pick and roll, and you have a guy and you just kind of toss it up to the rim and he finishes above the rim in an alley-oop. And so that collapses the defense the way a post-up used to collapse the defense. If the defense doesn't, then, you know, now the good centers catch that ball instead of dunking it. You know, they catch it under control and they pitch it out to one of the two corners. And if that shot's not open, then you get that swing action around the perimeter, and then you get a drive from the weak side or an open three. That's the game now. And, you know, I think if that's something the Raptors lack, they don't have a vertical threat. That's something they've got to develop or gain to be really, really elite. But I would say this, if you have the opportunity to get, you know, a guy who can post up, who can demand double teams, who can do all that and post up, like a Jokic, like an Embiid, like those are the guys that put you over the top.
So if there was an elite 7 foot back to the basket guy coming out of college who at one point would have been an automatic number one or number two draft choice, what do you do with that? If you're in that position and that guy's looking at you, do you pass?
You
got to look a couple of years out. You got to look at what your team might be 2 years out, 3 years out, because that's how long it takes those kids to sort of learn how to play in the NBA. Mm-hmm. Michael knows the Canadian kid, Zach Edey. He's going to be an intriguing guy because I don't know. Is he a vertical threat? Is he a stretch of floor threat? But probably not. But man, he's good.
He's for those who don't know, he's playing Purdue, only picked up basketball. It's funny, my kid played hockey against him. And he went like literally in about, I think, sixth or seventh grade. And he was like 6'5" then, but he's about 7'3" and wide shouldered, great hands, runs quite well. Like, he's not super quick. So to your point, Bob, 15 years ago, he would have been a lottery pick. Like, yeah, there's no question. And now it was a big deal just this week that he's crept into a second round consideration. And so the challenge for a guy like that or that profile player is, can you credibly guard in space? And so so when you look at why was Jonas Valanciunas in some ways super effective, is super effective as an NBA player, it's because he's big, he's strong, he's devastating on the offensive glass, he sucks up defensive rebounds. And around the rim, he can kind of hold his own. Why did he sometimes struggle and why wouldn't they play him in fourth quarters? Is because other teams would pinpoint him, try to get a switch so that he ends up having to guard someone smaller and quicker than him in space, and then they would punish that. Yeah. And so to Doug's point, if you're Zach Edey or any of these kind of players, you have to find a way to at least not be a victim in space against smaller players. If you can kind of hold your own, and, you know, Brooke Lopez in Milwaukee is kind of the gold standard for that, where you're able to kind of stay at the rim and guard, you can kind of defend and use your size to at least not be punished, then there is a role for you in the NBA, because being huge and is always going to be good in the NBA.
Where does this leave a guy like Achiuwa, who has, you know, I think he's what, 21 years old, has some potential. I think we see it now and again. But he's not really a center. And does he fit on this team? Smitty?
I think he could be the vertical threat that Michael was talking about if he could catch the basketball. And
they didn't want to say it.
Well, that's a bottom line. He's got bad hands. But you know what? We had this conversation, Michael and Nick, one day. You can catch teaching. They caught Serge Ibaka to catch the ball. And Achiuwa is 22 years old, really playing, well, it's second year in the league, but he didn't play much last year in Miami.
No.
And he never got to do anything in Miami because Miami didn't let him do anything. They let Jimmy Butler and Hero and all those other guys do stuff. So he's got a lot of potential to be that guy. But he has the fatal flaws. He's got stone hands right now. And you got to soften those hands up somehow.
And the question there, Doug's absolutely right. And the question when a guy is struggling to catch at that level is, very rarely can a guy just not catch. Like, the only guy I can really think of was, who's the guy who signed a huge deal in Charlotte? Big center, was with the Raptors from Congo. Oh man,
Bismack
Biyombo. He's probably the only guy I think of who literally couldn't catch. Like
Bismack, yeah,
you know, yeah. And that's why he's only ever been a role player. He was so good at so many other things, but he just could not catch the ball. most of the time, in my opinion, is when you see a guy like Precious, his problem is not that he can't physically catch, is that he can't, it's more that mentally he can't process quick enough to relax enough to, you know, make the kind of catches he needs to make. And so he's always fighting with his hands and his feet because his eyes aren't kind of absorbing the information at the rate needed to make him relax. And that's why Scotty Barnes is, you know, just such a wonder, because he's the opposite, right? Like everything, he's got those soft eyes, everything he sees goes right into his nervous system, and he just casually and easily makes simple play after simple play after simple play. Like he looks like he's been playing for 20 years. And Precious Achiuwa is the opposite of that. And so the question is going to be, over this season and multiple seasons, can he get to the point where, you know, he's calm? And when he's calm, he'll catch. And when he's calm, he'll finish. And if he can't get to the point, he won't be in the league.
Hey, Doug, you talked about Nick teaching Ibaka how to catch. How much teaching you, that type of teaching, do you think happens in the NBA these days?
With good teams, not much. With the Raptors, a ton. Like, there's a lot of basic skill work going on in before practice, after practice, footwork, catching the ball on the short roll, rolling to the basket hard, technique on shooting, like where your elbow is, where your hand are, how the ball comes off your hand, where your thumbs are. There's more teaching with this group than I think, well, since before, well, maybe when Dwayne Casey first got here in 2011. There's a lot of stuff going on because they're so young and they're so inexperienced. And like Michael said, stuff happens so damn fast. You gotta calm your body down. You calm your mind. The big phrase is the game's got to slow down for you. And I don't know how you teach that, but they're trying. And there's a ton of work. The Raptor development coaches, John Covaccio, Jamal McGlure, Jim Sand, like, they're out there every day with guys on rudimentary stuff. Footwork, how you come off screens, dip your shoulder, the technique of shooting the basketball. There's a lot of work going on with this group. As there has to be, because they're so damn young.
Well, yeah, in a sense, they are young and inexperienced, which are two devastating. That's a devastating combination, potentially. What does this team need? Or do they need anything obvious right now? Is there a piece missing? They could go out and you could say, well, they could improve here or they could improve there. But is there a hole in this team that they dramatically need this? Grange is looking off into space and wondering if he knows the answer to that.
I think they need, if you can snap your fingers, you would like one of Scotty Barnes and Pascal Siakam or somebody to become another really, they need another really good shooter on the floor all the time. Right now, if let's say their optimal lineup is the three forwards plus Gary Trent and Fred VanVleet, you really only got two really good shooters. And you know, I don't know if that's quite enough. You'd like three, if not four. So that'd be number one. And I think the other thing they do need is, like I said, a legit vertical threat, someone who can command attention at the rim and punish people there. And I don't know if Precious Achiuwa is going to get there, but he's certainly not there right now.
How much of a work in progress is Trent?
Oh, he's been a revelation defensively. He's got quicker hands than I ever thought. And I know he says, hey, I could always do this, except his coaches and his teammates are going, holy crap, he could do this? The way he defends has been, to me, incredibly good. And I don't know whether it's sustainable for 82 games and whether you get into a lull when you get a little bit bored and the season drags on and you're tired and you don't really want to guard hard. But, man, he's got some defensive chops that I didn't think he had. He's always going to be a shooter and a scorer and a volume shooter. Like the other night, Fred VanVleet didn't play. You can see his eyes grow big. Man, that's 20 shots I can get. So that's what he does. But the way he guards, that's made him. That's why I think he starts. And I think that's probably why they're going to stay with VanVleet, Trent, Anunoby, Barnes, and Siakam instead of going VanVleet, Barnes, Anunoby, Siakam, and Birch. Because Trent's been able to guard guys. And we didn't, he thinks he saw it coming. His coaches and teammates and the guys who cover him every day didn't.
I just question what his ceiling is, John. You know, he's not real big. He's 6'4" and a half, maybe 6'5". He's not super explosive. He does not get fouled much. He takes a lot of time to get into shots. As Doug said, he really likes to be, he really enjoys taking his time getting into shots. Like, I'm sure he leads the team in dribbles. And, you know, and I think, you know, if your team is really going to be as good as they eventually want to be, I think he's maybe a second unit guy.
Yeah.
And that's a position you could upgrade somehow.
Well, you talked about getting another shooter as maybe the need, but that's at the two, isn't it? Isn't that the place, Gary Trent Jr.'s place? That would be the one, the guy you'd replace?
Right. In theory. Yeah.
In theory.
Exactly. Yeah.
In theory, he would get all the shots off the bench. He'd come off the bench and get all the shots. He'd be Terrence Ross. He'd get a shot every time he touched the ball coming off the bench on an okay team. But as a starting two guard, I don't know that he's going to be a starter on a championship caliber team. He's good, no question, but I'm with Michael. I'm not sure how much better he's going to be than we've seen in these 14 games.
Well, the follow-up to that is if the Raptors at some point decide to juggle the lineup, it seems clear that Dragic is not going to play much. And yet, if you don't play much, do you get the return you want for a guy like that? Let's start with that question. Smitty, to you first.
The value of Goran Dragic is his expiring contract. And if you can rest a draft pick or two when you buy him out or trade him, then you've won the trade. You're fine. And everybody knew that from July when the trade happened, that he was not going to be here past the middle of February. Whether it gets traded or whether it's just simply bought out is to be determined. I know they're getting calls on him now because the season's at the point where teams are figuring out what they are. But if they can turn him into a couple assets, a couple second-round picks, I think that's fine. I don't think he's under no illusions of what his season's going to look like, and the Raptors are under no illusions either.
Michael, agree or disagree?
Yeah, I think Doug's right. I think they'll be lucky to get to get anything other than, I think in the end, it'll probably be a buyout. Like, you might get a second round pick out of that. But, you know, that requires, you know, you're taking back a contract to match money and all of that. Sure. I think the simplest solution will be at a certain point when, you know, Goran's got enough of his money that he's willing to accept some kind of discount on a buyout. And, you know, the Raptors are confident enough of what direction their season's heading in that they think they can kind of live without him. And I think they'll part ways and it'll be just NBA business.
So just to be the devil's advocate, why didn't this happen? Why after the trade, why not move him right away, Michael?
Why? Because I don't think there was a market. Like, I think he's a $20 million player. And I think if they could have found, a fit right away, they would have. And the one place that everyone talked about was Dallas, because of his connection with Luka Doncic. And I think the one player I think that the Raptors were a little bit interested in there was a guy named Moses Brown, who's a young guy. He's that vertical threat. He's 7'2". He's very raw, but in small samples has something the Raptors don't have. So you would have had to package him with somebody like Dwight Powell to make contracts match whoever. And the problem was Moses Brown wasn't eligible to be traded to a certain point. And I think Dallas at this point is kind of like, well, you know, why would we give up an asset if we just sit tight? He'll probably get bought out and we'll get him anyway. So I think that's probably the way that went down.
Well, if Dragic isn't going to play other than in emergency situations, which was the case the other night, that leaves Malachi Flynn as your backup point guard.
Leave Delano Banton as your backup.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah,
that's the big story is that he's basically become a backup NBA point guard for the 46th pick that no one had ever heard of 18 months ago.
And how impressed are you with him?
When he learns how to play basketball, he's going to be really, really good. Because right now he's just running up and down the floor doing stuff and crazy right. stuff and doing it well. When he learns the nuances of the game, if he learns the nuances of the game, I'm not going to say it's going to be Sean Livingston, but I'm going to say he's going to be awful close.
Well, what's happened to Malachi Flynn? I mean, obviously his stock has dropped. He was a draft choice of the Raptors. I think they had pretty serious expectations of his potential. Michael, what do you think of him right now?
He's a funny case because, you know, he's a pick and roll point guard, a really, really good pick and roll point guard for his, you know, for the amount of experience he's had. He's a good 3-point shooter. But this is a team that doesn't want to play pick and roll. They don't want to have the ball in, you know, a 6-foot point guard's hands all the time. And, you know, so he's got some habits he's got to break in terms of, you know, how he, like he, for example, off a defensive rebound, like he always wants to run back to the ball, grab it and kind of be the guy, bring the ball up the floor like he has since he was 7 years old.
Right.
They don't want to do that. They want to have, if it's Precious Achiuwa, God forbid, who gets the defensive rebound. And, you know, they want to give him the freedom to push the ball. And they want Malachi Flynn and anyone else to sprint ahead of that ball. And maybe one day Precious Achiuwa will pass the ball to someone who's open ahead of him. And good things will happen. But I think that there's just a little bit of a mentality fit that doesn't work right there. I think when they do sub Fred out, they want to go to a different kind of lineup with Barnes and Bantam and be really big. And you know, obviously Malachi Flynn doesn't fit quite in there. And I think they want to be a way more physical, a way more aggressive defender. Like, you know, I think Fred's clearly the template there, somebody who really just digs in and gets his, you know, he's at risk of getting his nose broke pretty much every game. So I think they want a little bit more from that, but those would be the obvious things. And outside of that, I just think that there's some disconnect there because, you know, I think in the spurts he has played, he's shown he can be pretty effective. But you know, for whatever reason, he's had a hard time just gaining, you know, turning 5 minutes into 8 minutes, into 12 minutes, into 20 minutes. That just doesn't happen yet.
Well, I want to address that specific point. Let's take a break and we'll come back and chat some more. Michael Grange, Doug Smith with us back after this. Colin and Shannon, Grange and Smith chatting basketball. The boys are in Portland where the Raptors getting set to play the Trailblazers. Again, ball movement was something we used to talk about a lot in the NBA. And I know the Raptors did and their coaching staff did. And when they, I guess, first got to be pretty good, maybe 10 years ago, the ball movement, particularly around the perimeter, was at its best, very crisp and significant. And, you know, you'd have 7 or 8 touches before they put up a shot. Now the game is much more stationary for the Toronto Raptors. It seems to me there are very few plays called here. Smitty, am I wrong?
No. And they don't want to call plays. They want to read and react. They want to run dribble handoff stuff, drive and kick stuff, swing stuff, that kind of action. That's they don't want to be 7 seconds or less, but they don't want to be much more than 9 because that it fits their skill set. They're quick. They're long. They can get to the rim. They can get out in transition, and they don't – like, it gets back to what Michael was saying about Flynn. You want – when the ball goes up, you want everybody except the guy who's going to rebound it to get up the court and pass the ball up the court and get into your stuff fast because against NBA set defenses, no one's going to be able to score. So you want to create advantages in manpower or size or confuse the other guys who don't know who to pick up where on the court. And you're not going to get a lot of high screen and roll, corner pass, swing stuff. You're going to get stuff off dribble handoff and read and react crap.
That brings up an interesting. I mean, you need a certain type of player to play that type of game, though. You need there's a bit of cerebral intensity you need for to play kind of Knicks style of offense, don't you, Doug?
Well, you got to be able to read what the defense is doing. You got to know where space is. And you got to know what the other guy on your team is going to do. And that comes with time. Now, they had the year they won the championship, they won game six running a lot of Fred VanVleet, Pascal Siakam, screen roll, and they had Kyle Lowry and DeQuan Leonard on the court.
Right.
So they can adapt. But, you know, it's they got a bunch of guys who just sort of alert. They're just running around right now. And when they run around with a little bit more purpose, I think they're going to be really effective. And that's the way they have to play. Because if they get in half court, they might not. They might be Kevin O'Neal offense.
Well, we don't want that.
No, we don't want that. Believe me, we don't want that.
Well, I mean, the pick and roll, the high pick and roll was like, it was almost every time they came down the court in years gone by. I don't remember the last time I saw it. And I see them try it every once in a while, but I don't see them do it effectively. Is that because they don't want to? Is that because they can't do it effectively?
Well, Doug's right. They want to play in transition. Part of the reason they want to play in transition is A, it's effective. Those are high quality, high efficiency attacks typically.
Yeah.
Well, not typically, always. But the other reason is an acknowledgement that they aren't very good in the half court, and they've been brutal in the half court. So far, they're, I think, 26th or 27th in the league in terms of points per play in those situations. And I think maybe last if you take away, you know, their ability to get their own offensive rebound. So they got problems. That is something that should improve with Pascal Siakam returning. And like we said, you know, saw a little evidence of that in the fourth quarter against Detroit. And, you know, like, I don't think that there's, you know, the teams that are typically really good against set defenses have maybe Kevin Durant playing for them. Right. Like, you have that one guy who, you know, it really doesn't matter what the defense is doing. He's going to get a quality shot. You know, and we've saw that, right. We know what that looks like, is he looks like Kawhi Leonard, but
yeah,
you know, absent that, you still need to be competent. Right. And I think that's going to be the ceiling for this team, is how competent can they be in those situations. And hopefully Pascal Siakam will help win that cause. I thought, down the stretch against Philadelphia, you know, there's a couple of possessions there where OG Anunoby took that role. Pascal was out, and they put the ball in OG's hands, and all of a sudden you had Gary Trent and Fred VanVleet as the guy who was playing off the ball, maybe their best shooters. And OG made two great reads and great plays out of the high pick and roll, or when there was a switch late in the clock, late in the game. So that's kind of where they need to get to. I don't think that this group is capable of being really good in that situation, but can they be kind of mid-pack? And that'll go a long way for them.
It seems inevitable. Siakam, Barnes, and Anunoby are going to play across the front. And yet there have been moments where Mihailuk has come in and looked very impressive. And you wonder whether... It makes you think that maybe he deserves more minutes. How do you feel about his game? And I'm quite surprised at what I've seen from him.
He's a lot more athletic than I thought.
Me too.
We knew he was a shooter, and kind of how he got in the league, how he made his bones, how he made his rep. But he can put the ball on the floor a little bit and get to the rim. He's basically fearless driving. I think he's a passable defender. But if you jerk his minutes off, who do you take him away from? I think as a eighth, ninth guy on your rotation, after a point guard and a center, I guess. See, I think my best lineup is VanVleet, Barnes, Anunoby, Siakam, Birch. You come off the bench with Banton, Boucher, Mikhailuk, and then Trent. And there you go.
Hey, it was actually that. So I was going to ask the question, and Doug, you kind of got it. How deep truly is this team?
I would say not. Depend. I would say 9 or 10. Like most.
You think they can actually roll out a not a bad five?
I just gave you 10 guys who are legit NBA players. Now how you parse out their minutes and how they fit with each other is, you know, that's coaching. You got to figure that out. But those are 10. I mean, legit NBA guys who can help your team win any night.
I'm intrigued by the starting five that you gave. Your preferred starting five. Grange, would you sit Trent from the starting rotation?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, not because he hasn't had a good year. I just think it'd be more interesting. You know, I think I would play I think Ken Burch is really good, gives them something they need for sure. And I think I'd be interested to see OG Anunoby at two guard. I mean, he might be the best shooter on the team, I guess, outside Fred VanVleet. And then you have Pascal Siakam at three, and Scottie Barnes plays four. And, you know, but I think in that group, you do have some spacing problems. But I think defensively, it has a chance to be – I think at least you would get a chance to see how good this theory is, right? Because you have five pro defenders, right? Like, you have five guys who – and Fred VanVleet, he's as the outlier, as Doug says, but, you know, he plays 6'10". Like, I mean, he is just an awesome, awesome defensive player. And so that, to me, would be the most interesting thing to see is how – can you smother? Can you dominate stretches and just force teams into bad shot after bad shot and turnover after turnover and, you know, just kind of play like that? And I would like to see that and see if it's feasible or not.
Doug, what kind of season, what kind of start has Boucher had? Because I keep hearing different things.
Not very good at all. One good game. The game in
Philly, and why and what do you think why is that? Well, I mean,
he missed a lot of time. He missed all of training camp in the preseason with thumb surgery or finger surgery, so he was set back. He just doesn't seem to have that same spark that he had. He doesn't run the floor as aggressively. It doesn't seem to me that he's had no discernible impact on any game except the one in Philadelphia, and I think that's mystifying. And I don't know. If you talk about what this team ultimately is, I don't know where he plays, because I think Watanabe is a better player.
Mm. Well, I wanted to talk about Watanabe, but
when he comes back, he's gonna have to play, because I think a more consistent shooter, not as athletic as Chris, but he's a better defender and he's as good as a better shooter, probably drives it better. So you got to see what you got with him. So I don't know. Chris is. I don't say they're going to give up on him, but I don't think he's going to get there's any kind of minutes for him when they get all their front court guys back.
Well, it's been said that he does not like to pass the ball. When he gets it, pretty much that's about it. Is that a fair assessment?
I don't think any of them like to pass the ball.
Well, I mean, I think the thing with Chris is he, like Doug said, got set back, significantly set back. And then came in, and all of a sudden there's way more competition for his particular bucket of minutes. And I think he felt it. Like, I think he pressed every time he was on the floor. I think once he had a few rough games, it kind of spiraled. I think he worked in this offseason at developing new things to his game, and rather than sort of, you know, kind of use them organically, he was like, okay, well, now I'm going to try that step back 3-point shot that I worked on all summer. Well, no, you know, that's not ready for prime time yet. And so I think it's a little unfortunate, because he did have that game against Philly, and you hoped, you know, just he's such a, I have such a soft spot for Chris. He's just honest and so, you know, unflinching in his own assessment of himself, that you always kind of cheer for a guy like that. And he's just had so many obstacles in his career, and time after time, when it looked worst, he's found a way to save himself. Mm-hmm. And that game against Philly was maybe an example of that. And then he goes and gets thrown on his back against Detroit, and he's out against, looks like he's could be out for a little while. And as Doug says, you know, the rotation's only going to get tighter. Anyway, I just want to throw that out there.
Well, let's address some of the other things that are going on, especially in the East. We're 12, 14 games in. So a lot of funny things can happen, and a lot of funny things will happen. But Washington, Cleveland are two teams that I think, well, I know I'm surprised that they played as well as they have. Are you guys at all? Is this sustainable for those two franchises? You know, Chicago, we knew they had a chance to be really good, and they may still be. Brooklyn, we should be the favorite in the East. But talk a bit about Washington and Cleveland.
I like Washington. I think Cleveland's a mirage. And with Sexton being out, I think they're going to regress to the mean. But I think Washington's got some They got some depth. They got some toughness. They got, you know, they made one of the best trades in the last few years when they traded Westbrook for three guys.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they didn't get a superstar for him, but they got three guys who are going to start and play big minutes for him. And they're Brad Beal's a good player. And I think that the Gafford kid looks pretty good. Dinwiddie's a good player. They got, I'm not surprised by Washington. Cleveland, I don't think is sustainable. I really don't, especially now with Sexton being hurt. But Washington's legit. They might be a top four team in the East at the end of the year.
Grange?
I agree with Doug on Washington. I mean, they just have a lot of good players, right? And they're well coached. And, you know, they were a decent team at the end of last year. And then they've just went and added three really good guys, two of whom have championship rings, one in Montrezl Harrell, who's, you know, been a league award winner and looks like he's going to be sixth man of the year this year again. So I don't see them. I don't know if they are top four. I don't see them collapsing. I think they're going to be, you know, a top six team in the East. I disagree on Cleveland. I think Cleveland's pretty good. I think as much as we love Scotty Barnes here, I think Evan Mobley is Scotty Barnes, who just happens to be 7 feet.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got all the same qualities, maybe not as rugged physically, but wow. He is a very, 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 very special player. You know, some of the, it's funny, the comparisons for him were maybe Chris Bosh.
Yeah.
I think he's more Tim Duncan. Like just when you factor in his level of defensive, Chris Bosh is never the defender Evan Mobley is. He's a playmaker. So, you know, and I like their overall team. I think that they, I'm not saying they're going to be top four, top six in the East, but, you know, I think that they're going to be a play-in team, and they're going to be a team that the Raptors are going to have to battle with all year, I think, for if the Raptors are going to be a play-in team.
I think the only thing with Cleveland is, will they decide to move Rubio for 2 years down the line? Because I think he's vital to that team. He's really good. He's their calming veteran guy. And if it's February and they can get two assets that might help him in 2 years, maybe they move him and take a step back at the end of this year. That's team management that you can't even guess now what's going to be like.
If Cleveland's in the mix, I'd be shocked if they did that.
Yeah.
Like that, you know, they've had their lottery picks. They've been through the mud, and I think that they need, if they have a chance, there's, to me, I mean, I know what you're saying, Doug, but I'd be astounded if they were to bail on a season if they're in the mix.
I just wanted to move Rubio so Pangos can play. That's all.
Well, okay. So my scenario there is the Raptors buy out Dragic, and Pangos gets bought out of Cleveland, and he ends up here.
I'm all for that.
Also looks like the Celtics seem to have turned a corner in the East as well.
As they should, right? They're a good team. I mean, yeah. I think things have simplified a little bit there. With Brown out, I think there's a little more ball for Schroeder. There's a little bit ball for more shots to go around for Marcus Smart. Tatum is Tatum, you know. So I think that they do have a little bit of a chemistry issue, almost like when they have a little too many chefs.
Mm.
But if they can sort that out, I think they, you know, there's a bones of an excellent team there, and I wouldn't. You know, I think they do have some chemistry issues, but you know, if they don't prove fatal, they should be a factor in the East for sure.
And Doug, what would you tell Sixer fans to do? Seriously, what would you tell them to do? I mean,
watch the Phillies?
Yeah, I don't know.
No, I don't know. They got, look, I've been saying this since June. They got to move Simmons. It's not tenable. It's not going to work. Doesn't matter what they say. Doesn't matter what they do. However they talk about it, they got to move them. And the sooner the better for all concerned. Now, what they get, 10 cents on the dollar, 5 cents on the dollar, 15 cents on the dollar, I don't know. But this, it's just not.
Right now they're getting nothing.
Right. It's just not going to work. And it's Danny Green got hurt the other night. So there's a bunch of that team is a little bit old. If Embiid, you don't know how Embiid's health is going to sustain for 82 games. It never has. Well, why do you think it would this year all of a sudden?
Yeah.
Tobias Harris is no spring chicken. Seth Curry's not a young man. I think they're on the downside, and they got to do something with him because it's going to be this cloud that's hung over the team since last June, and it's not going away.
Before we let you go, three other teams that I think much was expected of. Well, certainly Milwaukee as the defending champions. Indiana's always been a consistent, you know, fifth, sixth place kind of team. And Atlanta, who emerged a bit. None of them are playing well. Is that just early season trying to figure things out? Or is at least one of those teams going to take a big fall?
Well, I'm still confident in Milwaukee. I think they'll be okay. They have a kid named Giannis who should help them figure it out. I think you know, this is the third season, NBA season, in a 12-month period. And Milwaukee's been deep in the mix, obviously, in all cases. So I think there's probably a little bit of whatever. But yeah. I am surprised. I thought Indiana would be better. You know, Rick Carlisle's shown, you know, those guys are a really good offensive team. You would like to see them somehow defend, but I guess, and then I think, the other team you mentioned was
Atlanta.
Wow. Ton of talent. You'd think they would figure it out. You would think they would figure out, but sometimes when you got a team that young, that many young guys, it's just sort of hard to kind of know who's doing what at all times. And you don't know what kind of challenges they're having. But there's too much talent there for them to sort of not be in the playoff picture, not be in the top six. I think what you're really saying, Bob, is the East is really good. It's really
well, I am good. in effect, because there's four teams right now that are outside the playoff picture. And we expect that, I think, all of them to be in that.
And you guys haven't mentioned Miami yet. So.
Right. Like, I mean, if you look at the East, you know, Detroit, I think, is building something good there, but they're a little bit of ways. And Orlando has conceded, right? Like they would love to get the first pick. But there's 13 other teams who want to be in the playoffs and think they can be in the playoffs and arguably could be in the playoffs. And that hasn't happened almost since I've covered the league.
No. And you can make the argument that the East is at least as good as the West right now.
And I think it's better.
Well, yeah. I said at least, and it's been a while since we've been able to say that. Boys, time is our enemy. You guys better go back to bed, have a nap.
No, there's an M Club lounge here. My Marriott's going to be visited very soon.
Oh, there you go.
It's always our pleasure. You know, we're most appreciative of your time. We thank you very much and look forward to seeing you again soon. Thanks, boys.
Thanks, guys. See you down the road.
Doug Smith, Michael Grange, will come back and wrap it after these messages. Our thanks to Mr. Grange and Smith for joining us. No soccer tonight, but tomorrow night, they had how many? 48,000 in Edmonton?
Yeah, they did.
And they're expecting more than that for Mexico?
I believe so, even though it's a Tuesday versus a Friday. I believe so, Bob. I mean, let's face it. Mexico is a top 10 team in the world.
Well, yeah.
They're one of the best groups to play the game, period. And you know, they lost. The Mexicans lost to the United States on Friday night while Canada was beating Costa Rica. So this game has even more importance.
Well, Canada is now the only undefeated team, I think.
Well, the only team without a regulation loss. Yes, that's right. So, yeah. So if you look at the...
Well, you can't lose an overtime, John.
No. What I'm saying is draw as opposed to draws and all that. I mean, so
well, they're the only team who hasn't lost.
Yeah. When you look at the standings, there's only 1-0 on the board, and that is the loss column for Canada.
What do you think it would mean? You know, we've been talking all along, can Canada get third in that last automatic spot? You don't want to be fourth, although fourth you get another chance. What would it mean if they finished first or second in this group?
Well, it would be a shock. And when you think that both the Americans and the Mexican are rated higher than Canada is. Canada,
much higher.
Yeah. Well, Canada, right now, Canada's 48th in the world on the latest rankings. 48th, which is high compared to where we've been in.
Well, I get that, but still.
But that's why this game's important. Although I do think there's a real sense around the soccer community that there's still 7 games to be played. You don't have to run the table to get to the third spot, but if to beat the Mexicans to do that would be a huge, huge positive for this team.
Yeah, and they tied them in Mexico, which was a first for a long, long time, if not ever. Yeah. I can't remember whether they'd done it before, but I guess they had years and years ago. But
and how they did it too, Bob, because if you recall, the second half, Canada actually dominated the second half.
Yes, they did. Yeah.
And Alphonso Davies was again great there, as he was. And not just, I mean, Davies, their whole core of guys has played so well in the last few games.
We've only got about a minute, and it's not enough time to do it justice, and maybe we'll talk more about it later in the week. But is change coming in with the Vancouver Canucks? This miserable performance on the road the last three games, does it mandate that somebody's going to wind up losing their job?
I think it's possible. I actually asked a few questions of people yesterday. Is there anything imminent? I know I asked them before the game, before they lost 5-1 to Anaheim. They got outscored, I think, 19-6 on this road trip in the three games. But I, you know what, I mean, and the obvious one is that Travis Green might be in trouble, but I just don't know what Travis Green can do. And he's having a difficult time figuring it out with the momentum of his players. Travis Green has not gone from being a really good coach to a really bad coach in 3 weeks. He hasn't. He's still a very good coach.
But ultimately, W's and L's matter.
Yeah, yeah. Now, he's under a longer contract than Benning is. So, you know.
Maybe Benning is the guy that gets.
But you know, it's funny. We finished talking about the Raptors all the time. I think the Vancouver fan base is as passionate and peripatetic, good word, peripatetic as Raptor fans are. Very similar in their nature of the game.
Well, we will see how things develop there, and we'll talk more about it as they do. We got to go. For John Shannon, Bob McCown, we'll see you tomorrow. Goodbye, everybody.